Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
Legend of Takhti.
He was the best wrestler in Iranian history.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
Rumors spread that
he had been killed.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary, in the studio from the BBC World Service. This is the programme that hears from leading creatives globally. I'm Samira Ahmed, and I'm talking to one of the world's most high-profile and exciting architects, Daniel Libeskind. You might know Daniel Libeskind as the architect of the World Trade Center Master Plan. That's the redevelopment of the site in New York that was destroyed by the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And you may have seen his distinctive buildings around the world, such as the Jewish Museum in Berlin and the Century Spire in Manila. He'll be telling me about his moments of inspiration.
It has to sparkle with your kind of the eureka moment. It's like hearing a sound of a melody, or like seeing suddenly a mountain appear in front of you.
He's known for museums and cultural centres, but his work is wide-ranging and his studio is always busy.
Sometimes you look at it and you say, that's impossible. You can't build such a thing. But that shouldn't stop you. You know, you should never start with, what can I build? How much does it cost? How big is it? You should start with the impossible.
And I'm hearing about two of the buildings he's working on right now, an anthropological museum in Iquique, Chile, and a real passion project for him, the Einstein House. It's a permanent home for Albert Einstein's archive on the campus of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. It will house everything from his letters, his record collection, to his papers setting out his theory of relativity. It's early spring in the UK, and I'm catching up with Daniel Libeskind in London. The first stone has been laid for the Einstein House, and construction is underway. Well, I wanted to start by asking, taking on Einstein, widely regarded as the greatest genius of the 20th century, could be intimidating, even for you. I wonder how you approached the project or how the project approached you.
It's humbling. You know, this building for Einstein was discussed for many decades. And of course, Einstein is a name that is more than familiar to me because, well, who is not interested in Einstein? It's such an amazing project to be an architect of.
Daniel, can you talk me through the process that goes into creating a building like the Einstein House from the very first thing that happens and all the different steps?
Number one, you have to be at the site. You have to sort of put your head into the ground and listen to the site. What is the site really saying to you? And not just the audible site, you know, the busy classrooms and people running around, but what is being said in that site which is inaudible and yet there? And then you have to sort of reincarnate yourself into that site. You have to transmogrify your soul into that site. And then you also have to absorb the program that has been given to you, you know, which is very scientific, very particular, square meters. Each space has a definition. And then you have to somehow put yourself with your pencil and your mind into a state of wonder through which you can draw what appears to you in a moment of reflection. And I can't say that I can describe this moment very clearly, but it's like hearing a sound of a melody, or like seeing suddenly a mountain appear in front of you, you know, through the fog. And it's an instant process. It's not a you know, procedure of kind of unwrapping and slow discovery, but you have to be struck by a stroke of instant sort of line somewhere on that piece of paper. It's a kind of interactive project through a draw. And drawing is a mystery in itself. How is it that the whole world was created through a drawing?
And does it start with you with an idea and then is it a pencil and paper?
Always. I've never done a building just... But of course, pencil and paper are also dependent on your brain. You have to have inside your imagination something that you want to communicate.
Is the building that we're going to see that's in the plans that have been published, is it essentially the same outline as the first idea?
It is. It is. I think if a building is not the same as your first idea, it's a bad building. It has to sparkle with your kind of the eureka moment.
So when you do get as far as right, you've got the idea of the building and you get that first sketch, how then does it turn into something more detailed?
That's a great question. Sometimes you look at it and you say, that's impossible. You can't build such a thing that you just drew. Is this realistic? But that shouldn't stop you. You know, you should never start with, what can I build? How much does it cost? How big is it? You know, this kind of quote, practical question. You should start with the impossible. And sometimes I look at it and I say, how will this thing? And I abandon it. I don't think about it anymore. But at the end, it turns out pretty much like my first drawings.
So how would you describe what the building looks like and what the experience of going into it and using it
the
will be?
The building is a ever-changing form of what appears to be a cubic form, which becomes a curvilinear form that ascends upwards. It's difficult to describe it in words. It's made out of planar elements, but it's curves. Internally, the building is ever-changing because the walls are ever-changing. I thought a lot about what goes into the building, the exhibits, what will be shown. It all has to work as a kind of museum, archive, and an Einstein house.
There are teams of architects working with Daniel Libeskind. Once he's happy with his vision, they are there to pick up and run with it. One of them is Yama Karim. How do they work together?
It's quite collaborative. I mean, it's much more fluid and less methodical. Sometimes it can be born out of a computer. Sometimes it can be born out of a piece of text or a poem or a drawing. We don't really have a systematic approach. Each project is kind of its own creative process.
One of the things I think you've said about your approach is that it's optimistic and the importance of being bold and having boldness in the foreground. Tell me about that.
This is something actually Danielle has always spoken about, that there are so many professions that you could actually be a pessimist, even as a writer, as a poet, or as a songwriter, or any other profession. Architecture is fundamentally optimistic in that it believes in the future.
If a building has a good idea, it can develop. If a building is just a drawing and nothing more, then it can't develop. Then it's a failure. Then it's a folly. So you have to have a project that is robust enough to withstand so many voices and so many ideas that have to be integrated into it.
And your business partner is also your wife, Nina. How
yes.
do you collaborate together on a project
like
this?
Oh, my God. She's fantastic. She's much smarter than I am. And she, you know, she's not an architect, but she brings kind of a light to every project and an intelligence and an analytical power. She may ask me, like, why is this interesting? What does this mean? How much does it cost? Is it worth building? So she has very tough questions, and that always helps the architecture.
You might be surprised to hear that Daniel Libeskind hasn't always been an architect. He was working as a university professor when he won a competition to design the Jewish Museum in Berlin, Germany, in 1989. The child of Holocaust survivors, he realised that to get the project built, he would need to relocate to Berlin and, crucially, persuade his wife, Nina Libeskind, to join him as a partner.
Danielle asked me in the middle of an extraordinarily busy thoroughfare, Nina, I won't do this without you joining me as a partner. And I looked at him and I said, but Danielle, I've never been ever in an architect's office. And he looked at me and said, the same goes for me. So we both laughed and we said, okay, let's do this. And we started. We rented a ground floor apartment in Berlin, turned it into an office. It was incredibly difficult at the beginning. For me, it was a matter of figuring out, of course, what I was going to do within the practice. And at the beginning, I wanted to make sure I didn't cross the lines of interfering too much in Danielle's and the office's creative process. We have worked together 24/7, 365 days of the year, and it's just been the most amazing journey, I must say. So our day begins with music. We spend at least 2 hours every morning, whether we're in New York or in Berlin, we spend 2 hours listening to classical music and chatting and discussing not work, but the music. Sometimes Danielle is sketching. And then I get on the phone. And if I'm in Berlin, it means I can call China or Korea. If I'm in New York, it means that I can call Europe. So, yes, I am wedded not only to my husband, but to my cell phone. And that is indeed something that is almost 18 hours a day.
What kind of music do you listen to?
Well, in the morning, we listen to classical, everything. Whether it's modern music or Haydn or Bach or Schoenberg or Bartok, we listen to everything. And then in the evening, we have what we call jazz night, where we sit and we just listen to jazz and chat a bit about the day. And yeah, so we listen to music a lot.
When there's a commission and Daniel has an idea, I guess it starts with the drawing, then what? How do you go about turning his concept into the building?
Well, you know, we get the commission and then we meet with the client. Danielle walks the site because he never does a project without walking the site. And he immediately begins to sketch. And he then, if he's convinced of what he's done, because he's a very self-critical person, but if he's convinced of what he's done, he'll take photos of it or send sketches, if it's on his iPad, to the office. Once that starts, my job is to help to figure out the contractual part, because I'm not an architect. Sometimes it's easier for me to evaluate whether or not I think a client who very often are not developers or not architects themselves or engineers themselves need help to look at a drawing and understand what's going on. But I do bring into the process the political aspect, and every single project in architecture has a political process. My background is in politics, so I feel I have a chance to relate to the project in terms of its political viability or in terms of its political acceptance. Very often, Danielle is right on target, but sometimes I'll tell him, I don't think this is going to fly, and I think it's a dead end if you continue to work on that. He listens pretty carefully when I'm talking about the political ramifications of a project.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service with the architect Daniel Libeskind. His process is informed by wide-ranging reading and a commitment to philosophy and literature. Music has always played a big part in his life. He's a virtuoso accordion player and was a child prodigy, winning coveted music scholarships and performing on Polish television in the 1950s. I hope you won't mind me saying, but you were a child prodigy yourself in music. And I wonder how that, dare I say, connection to Einstein, how perhaps it's translated into your building.
It's a correct question, because it is a musical composition. It's like a scroll as you walk. The walls around you are like an ever-unfolding musical score. And the score is really a circular, but it's also cubic in its geometry. And so you are in a poetic space that has definitely an acoustical and musical quality in it. And it has a musical structure in its very essence, like notes, which create a harmonic set of kind of dimensions as you experience the building from different angles.
Was there any music that particularly inspired you when you were working on this, or that you think inspired Einstein that he was very fond of?
I always thought of Einstein and the violin. You know, he was a violinist. He loved, and I thought a lot about a violin, particularly the partitas of Bach as I was designing, because, you know, the partitas are really, it's a single instrument playing, but it's playing music that is bigger than an orchestral score. But it's also just an individual sound.
Now, some of your most famous buildings have been Holocaust memorial related, either museums or sites, as in Berlin or Amsterdam and Ottawa. It struck me that the Einstein House celebrates a life that could have been but wasn't extinguished by the Nazis. So it's a cause for great joy rather than grief. And I wonder how different that has felt to work on.
It's well put. It's such an inspiration to work on life. You know, what is it about? It's about affirmation of life across all the problems that Einstein encountered. Look, he was kicked out of Germany as a Jew. He was reviled, you know, as a Jewish theory, relativity. And yet, throughout all of this, he kept his humanity. He kept his belief in mankind. He kept his belief in peace. He kept his belief in nonviolence. What an amazing man this was. So that's what I'm saying. The Einstein is not just an amazing scientist, but an inspiring figure. And that is such a wonder to work on. You know, when you can think of the beauty of the world, the wonder of the world, and not just the shadows that often fall on it.
Jerusalem is a contested city, claimed by both Israel and the Palestinians. So negotiating the deep historical layers is particularly complex here. You're so famous for trying to capture all the layers of a site's history. And no site could have a more complex history, more layers, I think, than Jerusalem. It's your first building in Jerusalem, is that right?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
How did you reflect on all that? It must have been a big weight on you to take on.
It is. And maybe that's why the building is really different from my other buildings. In a way, it's simple, but has incredible complexity in it. Or it's complex that looks in a very, very simple way. Of course, building in Jerusalem is very unique, because it's such a historical city, and a city which is so beautiful and so historically significant to the world. So, of course, I'm using, you know, steel and concrete structure, but I'm also using the Jerusalem stone to make the building really, because it's, you know, self-shading form, it curves, it does amazing architectural things, and yet it is part of the landscape of Jerusalem. It has that coloration of the stone of Jerusalem. So it's almost like an organic outcropping of the land.
Inevitably, one has to ask, you know, given the Israel-Gaza conflict, it's a very difficult time to be talking about building something new, this celebration of scientific genius and human development. What are your hopes for what this building could achieve?
Well, my hopes is that people turn towards education, towards science, towards art, away from violence and away from conflict. That was Einstein's message. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm a not just a pacifist, I'm a committed pacifist, a fighting pacifist. I want to fight for peace. I don't just want to wait for peace. I want to fight for peace. That's an inspiration, I think, to anybody who looks at the world today in any part of the world.
How many projects do you have in the works
God.
Now?
I have a lot. I'm working in 14 different countries as we speak, but I'm a lucky architect.
Are there any in particular that are either coming to fruition or just
yes.
at that crucial starting
yes.
point?
Yes, I'm building a museum of anthropology in Chile, really close to the Atacama Desert in Iquique, which is very interesting because I didn't even know that they had some of the oldest mummies, even older than Egyptian mummies, which will be displayed in it. That's a fantastic project.
It's been a couple of months since I last caught up with Daniel Libeskind. He's joining me this time down the line from his studio in Berlin, Germany, for an update. So how's the Einstein House going?
It's progressing well. Of course, it's now a lot of it's in the engineer's hands, and it's costs of materials. We have to make sure that everything is, you know, on budget. And
is it?
Yeah, so... Yeah, it is. So far, it is.
Where has it got to? What would you see if you were at the site now?
Well, you'd see preparation of the ground. You'd see that there's activity on the site. There was, you know, formerly something else there. So you can see that there's a change taking place. And you see that sort of everything is poised for a moment when the building will rise itself out of that particular place at the university.
And I want to hear more about the Museum of Anthropology in Iquique, Chile. As he always walks the site before he starts drawing, how was that in Iquique, between the ocean and the desert?
It was really a revelatory walk because the site is right on the Pacific Ocean. It's right on the equator, and it's surrounded on the other side, on the non-sea side, with dunes, some of the largest dunes in the world. and they look like they're alive. And as I walked the site, I realized this is not just some sort of a secular project. It must deal with the spirits of this place, which are kind of inscrutable and difficult to fathom, even visually. You're surrounded by sand in great mounds and mountains of sand. So, yeah, that was an instant sort of realization that this is not a normal site.
And what was the immediate effect on your thinking and your process? Did you start sketching right there and then?
I had a sketchbook, and my immediate sense was there was a monster there. Little did I know that they actually call it a monstrous, kind of semi-sacred space. And I felt it, actually. I felt it without knowing that it was so named.
Can you give me an update on how that project is going since we last spoke?
It's just going, you know, through all the final stages towards construction. And of course, it's a museum, so it has to work well for the objects to be shown for visitors. It's quite a challenge. And it's done. We've got like 100 models of it, physical models in cardboard and various other materials. But I'm already in it. You know, it's interesting that even before a building is built, you're already inside of it. It's already in your mind, completely realized.
It's interesting. The Anthropological Museum project goes back, you know, 6,000 years, even further, back to kind of before modern kind of human memory is really properly recorded. And I wonder how you reflect that in a building like that Museum of Anthropology.
Well, look, there is no site in the world which is not full of history that exceeds our capacity to understand it. And even when you stand on a piece of, you know, a dune in Iquique in Chile, you feel that you have a responsibility to the past as well as to the future. And you know that there have been people walking through that site, and they were amazing people. They were not just, as historians still call them, you know, primitive people, or, you know, people who didn't have writing. They were people with equal, maybe greater imaginations than we have. And so you have to incorporate them to your project.
As with the Iquique Desert, Daniel Libeskind reveals the many layers of history embedded in a site and is known for his places of memory. Perhaps the best known is the World Trade Center Master Plan in New York. What was the experience of walking the site at Ground Zero?
Well, it wasn't even walking, it was descending to the bedrock of New York. It was not even a kind of a site. It was just an excavation where the ruins were just removed. And just going down some 75 feet below the street level, it's something so unusual in New York. You never see that. Only maybe construction workers ever experienced that. And as I walked there, really my world changed. My whole vision of New York changed. Everything I knew about those streets was very distant, and I just felt that I was in a place that I've never been before. And I touched that wall, that huge foundation wall. There was an engineer with me, and he said, "That's the slurry wall." And I didn't even know exactly what a slurry wall was, but it's a huge dam. And I felt when I touched it that this was somehow the very basis of the site, that had this wall fallen, all of New York underground, all the subways would have been flooded, would have been an apocalypse. And somehow that energy transmitted from that wall made me realize that the site was not at all about traffic and the infrastructure and all those things you really think sites are about when you're removed from them. But when you're in it, you realize it's about the fundamentals of New York. It's about the very ground you're standing on. It's about the catastrophe, but it's also about the ships that brought all the immigrants just right next to you. It was an experience that was so strong that I called my office. You know, it was late at night in Europe when I called them from New York, and I said, forget everything you've been doing. Forget all these studies and all these models and all these seemingly perfectly functional analytical studies. It has nothing to do with it. It has to do with this ground, and it's not about anything else. It's about something sacred.
That's interesting because, you know, the memory foundations are a big part of your design for Ground Zero. Tell me about that.
The foundation is the memory of those who perished. It's not the physical, you know, 16-acre site. It's really about the spirits that are there. And I really felt out of that memory, the design would come.
Now, I want to ask a bit about the pleasure of what you do, because I could imagine it would be a very fraught process getting a commission. You know, it might be exciting, but is it not something full of fear? I get a sense there's a lot of joy, or are there ever moments of fear in the process?
Well, you know, you don't have time to be either joyful or fearful. You're just in it. You don't have the perspective of reflection. You're really deeply in an experience. And that's, I think, the moment of creativity, when there is no past and there is no future. You're just in the present, and everything that is around you is creating that sense of what is authentic on the site.
Do you dream about the buildings?
Sure you do. You sometimes, in a dream, it's a kind of a nightmare, a repeating nightmare, that you see a certain detail of the building. And it's a kind of a message. And you wake up and you go back to the drawings and you think, what was that dream about? But there's always some clue to do something.
How often have you been told that's not possible and it's never going to get built?
Oh, almost all the time. Especially when you have projects which are, you know, ambitious, you know, whether it's Ground Zero or some museum somewhere or some, you know, even a housing project, which is a social housing. They say, no, this will never happen. There's so many skeptics in the world, so many people who are overwhelmed by sort of the external factors. You have to be a believer, you know, it's a matter of faith. And even if a building doesn't happen, it somehow has already happened. And it's inevitable that knowledge will be transformed into something that you will work with in the future. So, yes, there's no such thing as a waste in creativity.
We always think of the news story when there's a ribbon-cutting ceremony and a building opens to the public for the first time. As both projects are underway and not too far from completion, how does Daniel Libeskind feel about that moment with both the Einstein House and the Anthropological Museum?
To me, that's the moment of birth. That's when the building is just a baby, like an infant, like just born. That's the exciting part, because that's not the building. The building is going to age. It has to be built in a sustainable way. So as it matures, it becomes really a personality, a place you want to be in. And I think that's really the test of a building. You know, many of my buildings, when it first opened, people say, oh, what a crazy thing. Well, look what they built. They said it at Ground Zero. They said it at the Jewish Museum in Berlin. They've said it in many of my projects. But after a year, 5 years, 10 years, 15, it's become really a deep part of the city. That's the moment really to look for, the moment of how a building really matures in time.
You've been listening to the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service with the architect Daniel Libeskind. The programme was presented by me, Samira Ahmed, and the producer was Olivia Skinner.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.